Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. First Lady Michelle Obama shared some White House history during her address to the Democratic National Convention this summer.
The story of generations of people who felt the lash of bondage, the shame of servitude, the sting of segregation, but who kept on striving and hoping and doing what needed to be done so that today I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves. And I watch my daughters, two beautiful, intelligent black young women, playing with their dogs on the White House lawn.
The assertion that slaves built the White House set off a small bomb among conservative talk shows. Fox Network's Bill O'Reilly famously explained that those slaves were probably very well cared for. In fact, they probably weren't. And not only did 10 of the first 15 presidents own slaves or were raised in a slave-owning household, four of those presidents brought them to work in the White House. And because of that, the history of the United States as a slave nation is a little better understood. Author historian Kenneth Davis studied the records of those presidents and their slaves to write his newest book entitled In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents and Five Black Lives. He joins us now. Welcome to the show, Kenneth Davis.
Good morning, Anne. It is always a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
You begin the book with a note to readers about the meaning of words, especially the word slave. Can you talk about that for the purposes of our conversation going forward?
Oh, absolutely. I have, like many people, grown up talking about slaves, and a few years ago was introduced to the notion of enslaved person as an alternative. And somebody might say, well, this is just political correct and academic, you know, distinctions without a difference. But it is a real difference. To say someone was Washington's slave, it really is a description of possession and really cements that person's status as a slave. To say they were enslaved by Washington is a very different thing. It means they were acted upon by an outside force. So it has to do with, first of all, recognizing that they were, in a sense, a victim of something, but also not to simply categorize them as a slave, which has a connotation, and these were people who were enslaved. And when we think of them that way, and that's what I've tried to do with this book, by giving voice to people who were enslaved by four of our most famous presidents, four of our greatest American heroes, gives a very different picture of what slavery meant in early America.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the history of enslavement and the enslavement of black Americans by presidents. We're focusing on four presidents today and also five African Americans. My guest is Kenneth Davis. He's the author of a new book. It's entitled In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents and Five Black Lives. If you have questions, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. What did you make of the mostly conservative negative response to Michelle Obama's reference to the slaves that built the White House? So that was back in July. Your book wasn't out yet. What did you think?
I was kind of stunned, but not totally surprised, because this subject is never too far beneath the surface when we scratch away. When I say this subject, I mean the slavery and the question of slavery and the question of attitudes towards slavery. There's an implication in Mr. O'Reilly's response that, oh, well, they were well fed and had housing, that slavery wasn't so bad.
Mm-hmm.
That's the image that goes back to, you know, Gone with the Wind, the happy folk in the big house, and it's all very paternalistic. We can't gloss over the fact that slavery was a crime against humanity. 12 million people were stolen from Africa. Of course, a small portion of those, a small fraction of those, actually came to the United States. But once they got here, they continued to multiply. And so the million slaves who were in America in 1790 become 4 million by 1860. This was not a sideshow in American history. This was a central act. It was the source of political power. It was a source of financial wealth. And I think that when we diminish what slavery meant as a force in American history, and I thought that those comments diminished slavery, we do ourselves and history a disservice.
And this has been going on for a long, long time. It's getting better. But I remember visiting Monticello 30 years ago. The tour guide referred to the slave quarters as servants' quarters. And I you know, I was young, I was brash, and I challenged her. And she took great umbrage of that. She was very irritated. And I know that that practice has changed now at the homes of these former presidents. But how does that embarrassment and those years of embarrassment or just changing the facts affect our understanding of slavery?
That's a really important question, Anne, and I think that we are at a moment, and I think that Mrs. Obama's statements and the response to them and the discussion, going along with all the other things that are happening in America right now, it is a moment of reckoning. A few examples. We have Monticello, of course, now talking about enslaved people. They've rebuilt slave quarters on cabins. One of them is called Hemings Cabin. They fully recognize the fact of Thomas Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings now. Mount Vernon in Washington's plantation and home in Virginia is now opening up a new exhibit about his relationship with the people he enslaved. In fact, it was in the news over the weekend. The AP reported that Mount Vernon and both of the National Park Service are now acknowledging that Washington's descendants, or I should say his family tree, he had no natural descendants, are now acknowledged to be biracial. And this is part of the story as well, the close connection between these people who were the masters and the people they enslaved. It was an intimate 24/7 relationship and part of their lives and part of their world. And finally, we have things like the new Museum of African American History and Culture opening. It's going to change this conversation. And very much the conversation about race in the presidential election is front and center. Everything from the anthem protest to the role of Black Lives Matter to Hillary Clinton's campaign posting pictures of men in Klan costumes. So this is a part of the American dialogue, and it's important that we recognize how deep and how far back it's gone. History is not something that happened a long time ago and has nothing to do with us today. That's why we study it. The past is never really past, as Faulkner said.
But we have a penchant for focusing on the good part.
Oh, absolutely. We like to tell a history that's full of pride and patriotism, especially when we're teaching children about people like Washington and Jefferson and Madison and Andrew Jackson, who are the four presidents I focus on in these books. And we can't deny their accomplishments and role and importance in American history. Of course, Washington was, as a biographer called him, the indispensable man. But we also have to balance the scales. And for 30 years or so, I've been writing and talking about American history since I first published Don't Know Much About History many mm-hmm. years ago, and asking this question, how do these men who fight and sacrifice for the ideals of liberty and freedom and equality, how do they go back to plantations completely dependent upon slave labor? It's very easy to say, oh, well, they were men of their times, but that's too easy a pass as far as I'm concerned. They recognized the contradiction that their lives were at that time. Washington struggled with this question. Jefferson struggled with this question. Certainly Madison did. They didn't struggle with it enough to do anything really meaningful about it, but it was certainly an issue that they were aware of, the contradiction between a nation conceived in liberty and born in shackles.
They were men of their times, but they were exceptional men of their times, very well educated, and they wrote a lot. There's a lot of documentation about what you're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. Certainly, we know that Washington was thinking about this in 1786 or 1787, 10 years after independence. He's writing to some of his friends saying, I wish there could be a plan. No one wishes more than I do for a plan for abolition. But he did precious little, despite his power and prestige, to bring that about. Jefferson says the same thing. Madison says the two races can never exist equally. We have to do something about this. He also does precious little to bring that about. And in fact, the opposite. If we think about the U.S. Constitution and Washington's role presiding over the Constitutional Convention, Madison as the father of the Constitution, slavery was embedded in the U.S. Constitution. It was one of the great debate points of the Constitution. And when the founders and the framers of the Constitution decide that the enslaved population would be counted for the purpose of the census as three-fifths of a person, that cemented the power of slavery in our political system. It's no accident that four of our first five presidents were slaveholders from Virginia. Virginia's population was smaller than Massachusetts and Pennsylvania if you just counted free whites, but it was the largest state if you included the number of enslaved people. And those three-fifths of a person added to the slaveholding state's power. And that's why, as I said, four of the first five presidents, five of the first seven presidents are slaveholders, 10 of the first 15 and slaves, enslaved people are brought to the White House right up until 1851. Zachary Taylor was the last sitting president to bring enslaved people to the White House.
You asked the question repeatedly about the four presidents we look at in this book. How could men who fought for independence and believed to their core the principles of liberty and equality enslave others? And I'm wondering, through the work of your book and, of course, your entire career looking at hidden history, did you answer that question?
Well, I think there are a couple of answers, and they're not good answers, but certainly they were men who were completely dependent financially and politically upon slave power. We've talked about the Three-Fifths Compromise. That provided a tremendous measure of power, and Madison understood that when they made that compromise in 1787. In fact, we just celebrated over the weekend Constitution Day, the signing of the Constitution, September 17th, 1787, and that was a powerful piece of that compromise. Men at the Constitutional Convention had argued, why are we counting enslaved people or slaves? Why not? They are, if they're property, why don't we count horses or houses as well? But this was a deal breaker for the slaveholding delegates. If there had been no compromise on this issue, and of course they wanted the slaves to be counted fully, not just as three-fifths of a person. But if this compromise hadn't happened, they would have walked out of the Constitutional Convention, and who knows what might have happened then. So it's certainly part of their power, it was part of their wealth, and it was the part of their wealth that they wasn't very liquid. Washington was always worried about money because running his plantations was expensive, and he had very little cash. That most of his wealth, as was true of many slaveholding people, was tied up in human property. Certainly, if he had sold off all of those people, which he could have done, it would have changed his life completely. So they were, in a sense, I don't want to call them victims of circumstance, but they were certainly beholding and trapped in the system that they had created, which was an overwhelming one.
We're talking about the history of enslavement in the United States from the point of view of five African-Americans that are the focus of a new book by Kenneth Davis, my guest. The book is entitled In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents, and Five Black Lives. You have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. If you studied the Civil War growing up, you probably heard some reference to the nearly 4 million Black Americans who were enslaved at the time. But much of the histories of those people have been lost in the dust of time without much of a legal documentation that white Americans take for granted as they research their family tree and proudly display the photographs of generations of ancestors. Proof of births, deaths, marriages, most any achievement were not retained for posterity. Only the greatest families made note of their enslaved workers, and then only a very few, and from them, we get a piece of the history. Today, we're talking about presidents who owned slaves and a handful of those whom they enslaved. Still with us is the author of a new book entitled In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents and Five Black Lives, Kenneth Davis. And thanks again for joining us today, Ken.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. You know, I was just thinking about your last question. We were talking about Washington and the value of these people and why he couldn't just emancipate them. And a very good example of that is one of the stories I tell in the book, which is the story of a young woman named Ona Judge. She was actually enslaved in the Washington household in Philadelphia. She was Mrs. Washington's personal maid. She woke up every day and dressed Mrs. Washington and then put her to bed at night. Again, it was a 24/7 life. She escaped from the Washington household in Philadelphia. I described this entire episode in the book. And Washington then spent the next 3 years trying to track her down and return her. Why was that so important to him? Why didn't he just say, well, she made it, let her go? Well, Washington personally did not own a judge. She was what was called a dower slave. She belonged to the Custis estate. That was the estate of Martha Washington's first husband. That means if she had gotten away, George Washington was essentially on the hook for her. He would have had to replace her and return her value to the Custis estate, or actually pay her value. And that would have been very, very expensive to George Washington. So he spent 3 years as president, using the powers of the presidency, trying to track this woman down. She was found. He tried to send people to convince her to return to slavery, which was not successful, and then even concocted plans to abduct her, put her on a ship, and bring her back to Virginia. Again, a piece of the hidden history we don't talk about when we talk about George Washington.
Melvin in Pataskala, you're on the air. Hi, Melvin.
Melvin?
Hello. Hi, go ahead.
When this segment started, it sounded like we were talking about...
Melvin, you know what? I'm sorry, but we can't barely hear... Melvin, are you there? Yeah.
Yes, I'm...
It's very loud. Go ahead.
When this segment first started, it sounded like we were talking about the definition of the difference between slavery and enslavement.
Well, no, we were talking about referring to them as slaves versus people who were enslaved, acted upon.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Here's my question. We can talk semantics, but here's my question. Did George Washington and the other presidents who owned slaves, did they go out and take people and put them into the slave system, i.e. enslave them?
Uh-huh.
Or did they take people who were already enslaved and put them to work in their estate?
Okay. Kenneth Davis?
Well, I guess the question, I'm not sure I understand the question. If you purchased an enslaved person, even if you didn't actually go and capture them in Africa and bring them across on the Middle Passage and then go down to the auction, these were people, first of all, Washington inherited his first property when he was 11 years old, when his father died. He inherited the first 10 enslaved people he owned, and over the years added to that. The story, the first story in the book I tell is of a young man named William Lee, who Washington purchases at an estate sale, essentially. He's riding through the countryside, and these four young boys are being sold as part of the estate of a neighbor. Washington purchases four of them. Two of them are what are known as mulattoes, light-skinned, mixed-race people. Washington will use those two boys in his household because it was a status symbol to use light-skinned servants in the house. The other two boys were dark-skinned, and they were going to be sent to the fields. One of those two boys is William Lee, and when I say boy, he was about 14 at the time. He became Washington's personal valet, hand servant, his hunting companion. He was with George Washington every day for the rest of his life. He was with him at Valley Forge. He was with him at the crossing of the Delaware. He was with him when Yorktown is defeated. He was in Philadelphia when the Constitutional Convention is debated. So whether Washington actually went out to an auction or bought these people or they came to him through the Custis estate, it's really secondary to the fact that they were enslaved people and he continued to enslave them for the rest of their lives.
And he inherited, but he also went on to purchase many more himself.
Oh, absolutely. Over the years, he purchased a great many. He did stop after the American Revolution, and he writes about it. He stopped both buying new enslaved people as well as selling anymore. Certainly he had bought and sold people throughout most of his life. There's a very grim, gruesome story in a sense that I tell in the book about a young man named Tom who was a repeat offender in that he tried to escape. Washington gives him to a sea captain with the instructions that he should be taken to the West Indies and sold and be exchanged for essentially a grocery list. He enumerates the things he wants, sweetmeats, rum, molasses, and a few other things. So he reduced a life to a grocery list. I don't want to sound too condemning of Washington. As I said, we have to strike the balance here, balance the scales between Washington, the founder, the father of our country, and Washington, the slaveholder. And to do otherwise is to do a disservice to history.
Thanks a lot, Melvin, for that question. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the history of slavery, a slice of the history of slavery today with Ken Davis. He's the author of a new book entitled In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents, and Five Black Lives. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You write about just five people, Billy Lee and Ona Judge, who you referred to earlier. They were enslaved by George Washington. Then Isaac Granger from Thomas Jefferson's plantation, Paul Jennings, really interesting sounding kind of guy, I thought, a young boy in the White House of James Madison, and Alfred Jackson, who is buried in a Tennessee garden near Andrew Jackson. Why just five?
Why just five? Because I wanted to try and encapsulate the lives of these people. And these were people where there's no question that they had a sort of sense of privilege and they were different from the vast majority of enslaved people, first of all, because we know their names and we have some documentation about them. As you mentioned earlier, Anne, most enslaved people, we don't know when they were born, we don't know when they died, we don't know where they're buried. In some of these five cases, we do know those things, and we know them because there is documentation. Isaac Granger, later adopts the name Jefferson, is a perfect example of that. He was born on Monticello, and when he was about 5 years old, was in Richmond, Virginia, when the British attack, hoping to capture Thomas Jefferson, then the governor of Virginia. They're led by the way, Benedict Arnold, which is another story in itself. Those people, Jefferson escapes, and those people are then taken to Yorktown, Virginia, and are in Yorktown with the British when Washington is bombarding this tobacco port down there in the ultimate victory of the American Revolution. So we learn, because of this, that thousands and thousands of enslaved people were with the British in Yorktown when Washington wins the victory that completes America's quest for freedom. With that victory, Washington then went about to reclaim the property, as he described it, that was with the British. That included Isaac Jefferson and about 24 other people from Monticello, and about 17 people from Mount Vernon who had escaped early in 1781, offered their freedom by a British sea captain, and Washington, the first thing he did after the victory was make sure he returned them to Mount Vernon and Jefferson's people to Monticello. This, again, is the hidden history. We don't hear and see and know enough about this, and it's an important part of the past. And we have documentation for these five people. That's why I've included them.
Judy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Judy.
This program, your program today, is just outstanding. It's, it's just breathtaking. And I must commend the author for telling the story, limited as it is, you know, because, of course, I am African-American. You know, we talk about the president, and it's really like a cover-up. We tell basically what, no offense, what society, white people can handle. The presidents, not only did they rape the slaves, but they sodomized our boys. And those stories are never told, but they are passed down in our families from generation to generation. And I wanted the author to comment on that. And then, too, the residual effects that we inherit from our ancestors hearing this story.
Well, that's the history part of it. And thank you so much, Judy, for that call. Ken Davis?
Well, thank you for the call and thank you for your kind words. There's no question that slavery meant, especially for women, sexual slavery. All those mulatto children, as they were called, and they were later called by Thomas Jefferson, who categorized them as quadroons or octoroons. He actually came up with a racial system of categorizing how black or white, I suppose you could say, an enslaved person was. So this is part of the story we also don't tell. Yes, sexual servitude was part and parcel of American slavery. In this case, there's no record of Washington having such a relationship. We know that Washington was also probably sterile, perhaps the result of having smallpox when he was a young boy. Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings is now widely acknowledged. What most people don't realize is that Jefferson first encounters Sally Hemings when she's 14 years old, and she is the half-sister of Jefferson's dead wife. That is another part of the story, that there was this tremendous idea that especially Southern slaveholding women had to live with the notion that their servants included their half-brothers, half-sisters, children, nephews, and this is part of the perverse system that slavery was. And to the second point, which is a very important one, and I write about this in the introduction of the book, for centuries, blacks, African Americans were described as lazy, ignorant, dangerous, especially in the case of young black men. Of course, wives were taken from husbands, children were taken from mothers, a complete destruction of any notion of the most important thing we think about in society, the most important pillar of society was the family. It didn't exist for centuries in the African-American community because the fact was that slavery meant that weddings and marriages were the whim of a master, and a husband or a child could be sold away just on a whim.
Jim in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi. It's been a good conversation so far. I have a question for the author. What we're talking about basically are the presidents post the Constitution of the United States, starting with Washington. Prior to that time, there were seven, quote, presidents elected under the Articles of Confederation,
okay,
who basically established the office of the presidency for Washington to step into. Were any of those men also slaveholders?
Absolutely, and I've written about the presidents of the United States before the Constitution in an earlier book, which is called Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. But one of them, for instance, is his son is actually famous these days. One of them was Henry Laurens, L-A-U-R-E-N-S, who was a slave trader. He built an enormous wealth out of bringing in more than 8,000 enslaved people from Africa to America. His son was Henry Laurens. Henry Laurens became an outspoken abolitionist. He was one of Washington's closest young advisors during the American Revolution. He told his father, please emancipate those people. He did not want to inherit them. And he fought very hard for to include blacks as soldiers in the American Revolution, unsuccessfully to some degree. Henry Laurens gets kind of minor billing in the Hamilton musical these days. So that's why he's gotten a little bit more attention. So there's a perfect example of exactly what you're talking about. Of course, among the founders, we can count more than 40 of the signers of the Declaration of Independence in 1776 as slaveholders, and a great many of the 39 men who wrote the Constitution were also slaveholders. Again, I talked about that at the beginning, mm-hmm, how important slavery was to the creation of the Constitution. And, you know, sometimes we get a little bit too caught up in constitutional amendments and how things got compromised, and we forget the human side of the story. And that's what I've tried to do in this book, Anne, is really, mm-hmm, focus certainly on these people because they witnessed this history and they were affected by those constitutional amendments and the arguments over abolition.
Thanks to Jim for that question. If you have a question or comment that is civil and respectful, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there as well. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the history of five Americans, blacks who were enslaved by presidents and for whom there is a vestige of documentation. My guest is author Kenneth Davis. He wrote their stories in his new book entitled In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents and Five Black Lives. If you have a question or comment, once again, civil, respectful, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Portrait artists, Ken, of the day, sometimes captured black people in their pictures of great families. What do you make of that?
Well, I think there's a this is interesting because I open the book with essentially a portrait of the Washington family in which George Washington, it's dated from 1796. Washington is depicted, so is Mrs. Washington and their two grandchildren who they adopted and raised as their own, Wash Custis and Nellie Custis. In the background of that very famous painting stands a man in livery, a black man. His face is seen only in profile. We don't know who that is. And I actually open this book by asking, who is he? And no one really knows. It's Is it Billy Lee, the young man I discuss in the first chapter of the book, Washington's longtime valet? Is it Christopher Shields, another young enslaved man who took Billy Lee's place when he became too old? There are a number of other possibilities, but no one knows for sure. We don't know what most enslaved people look like. Even Billy Lee, who was probably the most famous man of the late 18th and early 19th century, black man in America. People knew his name. He was discussed in the newspapers. He's depicted in paintings by Trumbull and other famous artists of the period. He's usually depicted wearing a rather elaborate, ornate turban, which I think art historians will tell you was meant to suggest his foreignness as an African-American. We don't know if that's an accurate portrait of him. We know that the portraits of Washington are pretty accurate. But that's why I called the book In the Shadow of Liberty. These people lived out their lives in the shadows of these great men and left out of our history books, which tended, certainly for most of our history, to gloss over this aspect of these great Americans' lives. And it's too important a subject, as we're seeing play out in the country today, to ignore how important slavery was in America, early America, in terms of the wealth and power and the society it created.
In the second chapter, you tell the story of how from the late 15th into the 19th century, some 12.4 million people were loaded onto the slave ships and taken across the Atlantic in the slave trade. A fraction of them ended up in the colonies. Why was that larger history important in telling the stories of these five people?
Because I think it's still something that we tend to gloss over, and we aren't some of us aren't fully aware of the enormous magnitude of this great crime against humanity, which I call slavery. Many, many other writers have written about this subject far more eloquently and in greater depth than I have, but I certainly wanted to introduce the role that slavery played in the founding of America. We forget sometimes that African Americans were sold in the United States, what became the United States, before the Mayflower Pilgrims arrived. The first documentation is a group of Africans sold to Jamestown, Virginia in 1619. So this is baked into the cake of our history, so to speak. And I think that because people do tend to still think that this was a practice that was limited to a part of the country, done by a small number of people, that's a misimpression that I and a misconception that I feel is very important to overcome. Every one of the 13 original states allowed slavery and had slaves in some form or another. It's only well into the late 18th century that some of the states begin to ban slavery, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania being the first of them. And that's an important point, because when George Washington goes to Philadelphia as president in 1790, there is a Pennsylvania law that calls for the emancipation of slaves over the age of 28 if they stay in the state for more than 6 months. Washington knowingly and deliberately evaded that law by shuffling some of the people in and out of Philadelphia, which was specifically against the letter of the law. Again, he was the little boy who couldn't tell a lie, but he was willing to break the law to retain these servants and not to risk their being emancipated or the fact that they would learn about this and want to escape, which some of them did.
You wrote that slavery was the key to the conquest of the Americas and that it also powered progress. That was your phrase you used, and that it was a central feature. When I'm reading about, when you put it that way, you have to question, would we not be the country we are today without it, good or bad?
Well, absolutely. And again, this goes to the misconception or mistaken notion about what slavery really meant in early America. By the turn of the 19th century, it was the most valuable piece of not just American trade, but global trade. That's how these enormous fortunes were created. And we know that those fortunes, of course, weren't just limited to Southern slaveholders in places like South Carolina. The Brown brothers, who were ultimately the founders of Brown University, had their beginnings, and some of their wealth comes from slavery. And a great many universities, as you probably know, Anne, are starting to come to terms with that piece of America's legacy in the role of these universities. Harvard has just placed plaques in honor of some of the enslaved people who worked in Harvard. Brown has done its acknowledgement. A very riveting story recently has come up about Georgetown University having sold more than 200 people away when it needed funds to stay afloat financially. The current administration of Georgetown actually went and tried to track down any descendants, and they've done that successfully, and tried to atone for that. They've even offered admission to the descendants of any of those people who were sold away to keep the college afloat in the early years. A man just was arrested and then released because he broke some stained glass windows at Yale because they depicted John C. Calhoun, one of the great apostles of states' rights and certainly one of the great voices for the slave power.
Let's see. I want to turn to Tom in Upper Arlington. You're on the air. Hi, Tom.
Oh, hello, Anne. And I want to just say thanks to the author. You have a lot of talent, and you're very articulate, and this book is a massive contribution. So keep getting out there. Keep spreading the message. I think words matter, and there was a phrase that you've used, and I'm wondering about the genesis of this wording. And I think words matter, and it's as good a label as you can get with this stuff. And you're referring to enslaved people as opposed to slaves. And I like the term enslaved people in that it affirms that these are people. and I was wondering, how did you come up with that term? Is that something commonly used among historians? And to everyone listening, I think that that might be a better term than just to label people as slaves.
Thank you for the call. Anne and I discussed this perhaps early in the show. You may have missed it, the use of this word. I actually include a note to the reader at the beginning of the book, In the Shadow of Liberty, explaining how and why I use this. I certainly did not coin it. I think it's a phrase that became much more commonly used in the academic world and the academic literature, perhaps in the last 20 years or so. My very smart daughter, who was studying history and literature, pointed it out to me a few years ago, and I have been trying, sometimes without complete success, to replace the term slave with enslaved people when referring to these people, because as I told Anne when we began, it changes the way we view people who were, in a sense, victims of a system, and it changes the idea that they were just slaves. That's a very simple word that connotes something, and when we call them a person who was enslaved, I think it changes our view of them. They do become human beings who were caught up in this system, as opposed to being just numbers on a chart or a logbook or an overseer's manual of who was owned. And certainly the presidents themselves saw these people, their enslaved people, as almost members of their family. Jefferson uses that phrase. Andrew Jackson uses that phrase. He says, my people. Washington uses that phrase, my people. So the intimacy that suggests is part of the story that I've tried to tell, that you could not imagine living. We think of Washington sitting down with Jefferson and Madison and at the dinner table, but the dinner table was then surrounded by these people who were watching, listening, and certainly talking sometimes to their masters, their legal and technical masters.
Sandy in Logan County, you're on the air with author Ken Davis. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Ann and Ken.
Sandy, could I interrupt you? Sandy, could I interrupt you? Pull the phone away from your mouth.
Okay. Can you hear now?
Yeah, but you could pull it farther away.
Okay. I can barely hear you because I'm on a cell phone, but I'll try. Let me just view this out. Okay, first of all, this is great. I'm actually sitting out in the parking lot. I'm a college professor, and I've just come from a class, actually two classes, in which I just related a story which happened to me. I had no idea, Ann, who you would have on today, but this really fits. This goes to show how close we are. It's not even so much history anymore. I told my people in class, I said when I was in university, this is in the 1960s, there was a woman who lived, a little black woman, who lived on a hill in a little town. There were about 12 people in this town. And I remembered one day I stopped to see her. She was a tiny woman. And I said, oh, you know, how are you? She told me she was born in slavery. I could not believe it, which was completely possible. This was 1964.
Oh, okay.
So she was born in 62 or something, 1862. And I remember she says, oh, you know, just give me, can I have a lock of your hair? I had a cough at the time. And she said, I'll take your hair and I'll help you, some kind of black magic. But the whole idea that woman, that little woman living at a crossroads in our county, you know, had been born in slavery and she was jolly and she told me about this, and that I could relate that to the young men and women sitting in my class today. It seems like it's not so much history. It's an oral tradition that I could pass on today. So what this man is doing in this book is tremendous.
Thanks, Sandy. Appreciate your call. Ken Davis, you wrote about five people. A lot of that is a function of what's out there in the written record, right?
Oh, of course. As I said earlier in the program, we know these people and know pieces of their stories because they were in the households of presidents, and there is reference to them, and there are records of them for which there are no similar records for the vast majority of the millions who were enslaved over centuries. Frederick Douglass writes in the narrative that he'd never met a slave who knew his birthday. And that's an astonishing idea, but that's part of what we're talking about, and that's part of why I called this book In the Shadow of Liberty. I'm trying to bring these lives out of the shadows, and fortunately, we do have more records. And to the caller's point, it is very close to us. The last story I tell is of Alfred Jack. He goes by the name of Jackson. He was a young man when he gets into a bit of a trouble at a Christmas party. Someone is murdered in a fight, a brawl, perhaps fueled by alcohol. Yes, enslaved people went to Christmas parties. That's part of the story I want to tell, that they had lives and they did things like that. But then Andrew Jackson, at great personal expense, actually went into debt to pay for the defense of Alfred and three other men who were ultimately acquitted of this crime. Andrew Jackson also went to the trial every single day. There he is, the former president of the United States, the most powerful popular man in America at the time, without any question. And what that must have meant to the jury that was sitting there listening to this trial. As I mentioned, all four men are acquitted. So that, is, again, speaks to this very, very close connection between these presidents, these famous men, and the people who they technically owned. It's a very, very complicated story. When Jackson dies, these people are at his bedside. They're not depicted in the famous drawings of the time, but they were all there. And so Alfred Jackson is quite extraordinary because he actually lives into the beginning of the 20th century. He remains at Jackson's Hermitage Plantation and becomes essentially a tour guide for the generations who come to visit. And if you go to Jackson's grave at the Hermitage, there beside it is a headstone marked Uncle Alfred. And that is the gravestone, one of the few that we can identify of an enslaved man who lived into the 20th century, the property of a president.
Ken Davis, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Anne, and people can learn more at don'tknowmuch.com if they want to learn more about the book.
Ken Davis, author of In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents, and Five Black Lives. Thanks to everybody for your calls. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.